There we go.
Okay.
And it's just because we need to set it. Let me just check the model.
It's a good thing, Sean. Yes.
He's also buying me some time to make sure that that link out.
It's okay with those, Sean, because we'll just have him come to the podium and me.
Okay, because the podium, it'll pick it up on there, so it'll be recorded, but it'll be, won't be as loud.
I'll be quiet.
Yes.
And then we'll look into that after.
Yeah, I'll get with Aiden and we'll try and troubleshoot. I don't know. I think when they were putting that little step in there, something became disconnected. So
okay,
we'll get taken care of.
Thank you, Sean. Mr. Irvin, let me know when you're ready.
We are currently in recording here, so we are good to go. We need to be we're good.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome all of you to the Los Angeles County Board of County Commissioners, acting in the capacity as the Board of Human Services. Today is Tuesday, November 19, 2024. Sincere apologies for a little bit of a technical difficulties. It is now 1:04. I'm calling the meeting to order. Please rise for an invocation by Commissioner Tony Haas, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance.
Dear God, today we come before you with gratitude in our hearts. Thank you for the blessings of a new day. Be our strength and guide so that we may overcome all obstacles in our way. Please preserve us and deliver us from our sins. Watch over our loved ones, keep them free from disease and harm. All this we ask in your heavenly name, amen.
Please join me on the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Roll call, Mr. Aragon.
Commissioner Haas?
Here.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Here. And we bring a sincere apology on Commissioner Luis Lopez is on a different meeting, so he may be able to join us here in a little while. So thank you so much. Approval of the agenda. Do we have any changes to the agenda, Mr. Aragon?
Commissioners, no, I do not believe so. Ms. Pollard, we sent those over the September and October
meetings?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So then, no, we'll keep that on. So we are
okay.
Set as is, Commissioner.
Thank you. Then I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
Move to approve the agenda.
I second the motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes. Thank you. And we have the minutes attached to this. Those as a consent item agenda, Commissioner Haas, September 17, 2024, regular meeting minutes, October 15, 2024, regular meeting minutes. Any questions on that?
No.
I will entertain a motion.
Move to accept the September 17th, 2024 regular meeting minutes. I say October 15th, 2024 regular meeting minutes.
Thank you, sir. I second that motion.
Commissioner Tony Hass.
Yes.
Commissioner Fingers Lopez.
Yes, thank you. This is the part of the meeting that anyone that wishes to address this board will have 3 minutes on the public comment. Anyone here in the audience and or online, simply unmute yourself, raise your hand. You have 3 minutes to address the group. So hearing none, we're going to go to the director's report. Once again, good afternoon, Mr. Aragon, and the floor is yours, sir.
All right. Thank you, commissioners. I think there's two topics of discussion today, and I'll go into the second portion, which I think will probably be our deeper discussion regarding our child care assistance program. But I did want to report to the board that we, as a state, continue to see concerns with SNAP benefits being stolen across the state. The state is still working to try and shut this down. We have provided some social media guidance for folks within our community on how they can prevent their SNAP benefits being stolen and or frauded against. And we encourage our residents to contact our fraud department should they have any concerns. They can contact our main line at 846-2276 and ask for fraud. But our fraud investigator continues to look at that. In most cases, we are able to restore those stolen funds, but we obviously need to follow the process. So we ask that any resident who feels that EBT benefits have been stolen and or frauded to contact us immediately so we can jump on that.
Mr. Aragon, for purposes of a record, tell us, how is this happening?
Well, what we are finding is that the primary way of benefits being stolen is using what they call a skimmer, which is essentially a device that's installed either on a credit card machine. Oftentimes, we most see them at gas stations. They're either installed when somebody's putting gas. It is a cover that looks exactly like the credit card processing area where you insert your card. When you scan that card, it pulls the data from that card and sends it to somewhere else, not to the actual agency that receives that payment. And so I know our fraud investigating team came in a couple months back and reported to the board regarding this. And again, it continues, but the state is working to try and shut that down as best as possible. The majority of that we've seen in the larger metropolitan areas. We haven't had a ton here, which we're thankful for, but ultimately, folks that are visiting Pueblo, there was some origination from a gas station in that area that impacted us when residents from here were in Pueblo stopped and used their car, and it obviously picked up that information. So,
again, does it totally focus just on that card, or does it actually pick up on any card you have?
It will pick up on any card. So it's not just EBT cards, it can be a debit card, a credit card, anything that's used in that skimmer can pull that information. What we're finding is that the data is being sent to addresses listed for the entity receiving the payment. These addresses tend to be vacant lots in metropolitan areas where there is no building and or is a vacancy. And they're using these false addresses to set up these bank accounts so that they drop in those funds once they process through the merchant.
So is that phenomenon going on only in Colorado, for the most part nationwide?
And I believe, Commissioner, it might have been you that forwarded an article to me at some point, but we're still seeing that across the board. In fact, there was another report of misuse in two other states, and I can't recall which states those were, but we've also seen usage of EBT benefits in other states, which is not allowed. And so we monitor that very closely, as we do obviously sit on the border. We have a sister city in Raton. Sometimes our folks do go over, and so we do work with Raton and Colfax County to ensure that it's used appropriately if they are over there. However, really SNAP benefits should be used within the community that it's received. So.
Has the state estimated what is the dollar amount, at least estimated,
I don't have a number off the top of my head. I don't recall them putting that out. I do know we're in the tens of thousands at this point, but we're not, I don't believe we're at the million mark yet. So
no.
I'm not sure what that number looks like, but I can definitely dig into that and report back at the next meeting.
Thank you, sir.
Commissioners, the second item on the discussion today is the Child Care Assistance Program, or the CCAP program. I reported in last month's meeting that there were concerns regarding funding restrictions and decreases in allocations. There was also discussion around the Indian federal rule implications that it would have financially upon us as a county, but also statewide. And so in the last month, I've been working to get clarification on that federal rule, to identify what that financial impact will look like for us as a county and what this potentially could look like for some of our local providers. We will be meeting, and Mr. Henry, who's our lead tech and special programs who oversees the CCAP program, and I will be meeting with our local providers this Thursday and Friday to discuss this in person with them. But ultimately, to go to the document in front of you that I provided, this is a breakdown of several different things. The first is the number of students or count that we have within our county. And at this point, our data shows that we actually have 57 students enrolled in the CCAP program, which is less than I originally had anticipated, as I believed it was 85. But Mr. Henry ran that recent report, so we are down to 57. However, that does not mitigate any kind of financial impact upon the county. It lessens it only in retrospect, which I can't believe I'm saying this, by a few hundred thousand dollars in the year. Essentially, right now, based on the federal rule, we do know that on average, because we pay per attended day at this point, the federal government is requiring the state to move to a pay for an annual year for each child rather than per day. We average about 22 days a month in the calendar month that we pay towards. And on average, the state is estimating that it costs about $6,600 for a youth to be in the CCAP program annually. With the new federal rule, that jumps that number significantly from $6,600 to a $17,000 per student per year cost. It is triple the current amount, essentially. With that being said, if you look at the average in the first section there, you'll see that currently under the $6,600, it would run our department approximately $376,200 in a year to fund a student under the current pay structure. Moving to the $17,000 per student per year, we're looking at an increase to $969,000 for child care assistance programming in our county. That's a 257.58% increase in the next fiscal year. If you will jump down a little bit beyond that, you'll see kind of in the middle of the page, the current allocation projected for EFT, which is our electronics funds transfer. That's our payments directly to our care providers. Right now, our current allocation best estimate based off of current spending this year is about $306,783 is what we're projected to spend in electronic funds directly to providers in 2024. That breaks down to a monthly rate of about $25,565 and a daily rate of about $96.84 per child. If you look at the projected for 2026, you'll see that there's a jump from the $306,000. The mandate will be $952,000 with the number of students we currently have enrolled, which changes our monthly contribution to the program from $25,000 to $79,000 and some change. And our daily rate jumps from $96.84 to $300.51 per student per day. So in that next section, you'll see that the projected amounts are for 25, 26, and 27. Keep in mind, commissioners, that we cannot disenroll students that are currently enrolled in the program. So they have to age out. When we look at that data from our programming software, we show that we are only expecting one child to age out in 2026 and one in 27. We do not show anyone aging out again until 2029. With that being said, in 2025, our projected EFT with the current allocation, we are expected to be at $214,414.77 overspent in that program, with an increase of 169.89%.
This is with the current children? Because what do you expect to increase every year? Do you expect that to increase?
Or? We don't expect the allocation to increase.
The number of enrollees?
The number of enrollees, and I'll get to that because we're going to talk about a policy that will be coming to the board here shortly because of this. In 2026, our projected for, again, we'll have one youth age out. With the current, with the new spending requirement for the federal reimbursement rate to providers with 56 students, we're looking at a $1.3 million overage or 527.20% increase. And in 2027, again, with one youth aging out, we are pitted to look at, again, about a $1.339 million overspend of about a 536.62% increase to the program. So realistically, based on the allocation amount we received, that $1.3 million in 26 and 27 is added to the allocation amount. So technically, we would be looking at spending a little over $1.6 million for that program, based on that requirement. As the board is well aware, we've worked very hard in DHS and within the county, obviously, to create a financial cushion in case we had an issue. But this is beyond what DHS's financial fund balance. And I've spoken to Finance Director Coberly about this program as well. She is aware, and I'm going to provide a copy of these numbers to her today when I leave this meeting. But ultimately, this is an impact that once DHS's funds are depleted, would have to go to County General to cover that cost. This is a significant gap in funding that the state has created for the counties across the state. And I was contacted by another county director just prior to this meeting asking if the commissioners here would consider submitting a letter to the state regarding concerns about this. And so I think now that we have the actual data in front of us and we're having this discussion, I think we need to look at potentially doing so. I have not heard from the Human Service Directors Association any kind of collaboration with CCI, but I have reached out to Heather DeRosco, who's the director of CHSDA, to ask her if there would also be any kind of communication from that agency along with CCI to the state and to JVC with this requirement.
You know, as we go forward, what I'm thinking, I can only imagine what kind of conversation we're going to have at CCI once we all come together under DHS division. The total impact to counties, that's going to be the larger number. What the sum of all counties, I would imagine, is going to be just astronomical.
It will be in the billions. But I mean, we're not even, and I will say this at this point, Jefferson County is one of the current agencies that we know has traditionally been significantly overspent, both in their Colorado Works and in their CCAP allocation. They are currently closing within Jefferson County several childcare classrooms at this point because the providers know that this funding is drying up and that there will be no way for the county. And even Jeffco, who's our largest of the counties, is not capable of supporting this. I mean, this is just an ask from the feds and from the state that counties cannot in Colorado support. There is a CCAP allocation committee that's formulating to look at that allocation model. And we were one of the counties who agreed to be interviewed as part of the CCAP to the state, what the concerns were. One of the major things that I reported to the state and that they are now taking back to the feds is the consideration that for us as a county, and I've spoken to Director Blasey at South Central Council of Governments, this kind of a mandate and us having to age these youth out in that 3 to 5 year timeframe would hit their books so significantly that they would potentially look at having to close their doors because the county would not be able to fund this over the next 3 years, which means we would lose our largest care provider. That includes an impact to our economy, our workforce, our unemployment rates. I mean, it just is astronomical, the escalation of this program.
What is the common sense fix that will need to be, of course, money, right? Or, you know, the the intrusion of the federal government?
I think the major issue, Commissioner, to think about prior to this is that the state of Colorado has in for decades with this program underpaid what the federal mandated rate of return or rate of pay to the provider has been. And because the state has been non-compliant in that rate, now the feds have said you must meet that mandate, which is that $17,000 per youth. That being said, because we have, as a state, historically underpaid the provider, we're now paying the consequence for that. But I don't understand how, as a state, we are an arm and agent of the state in the county perspective, but we are not the state. We were not at the table to make that decision as to what rate should be reimbursed to providers. But yet the counties are now expected to take the brunt of it.
And you know, right now the state is close to $1 billion downfall to balance in their 2025 fiscal year budget. Counties alone, I mean, you're looking at possibly another $1 billion for 2025 on this mandate. How long or when did the federal $17,000 threshold? How many years did we operate pretty much on our own?
Well, to my knowledge, and I don't know when and I know Mr. Henry is online with us, he may have this, but I'm not sure when the CCAP program was initiated in Colorado, unless anybody in the room might know, but
my kids were on it.
I would assume 10, that we
15 years ago.
Yeah, I would assume that CCAP's been around 20 or 25 years or more. It may even be longer, might have been something different then.
It's been around since I started, and that's 40 years ago.
And so, my question is, when did it go from, when did it rise up to the $17,000? And of course, I'm going to ask him why, right?
I think federally, those have probably been increases, incremental increases over the years.
And that's where we're at right now at the national level.
Yeah. So we have traditionally been non-compliant with federal rule on the TANF dollars that are used for this program. And I think primarily because there's a really fine balance between the state TANF reserve and the TANF programming that's provided. We have three programs that fit in that TANF realm. Colorado Works, which is our primary CCAP, our child care program, and then our child welfare block, which is part of that process. Those TANF dollars and the funding models for each of those programs is different based on the need.
But when you put all the three programs together, regardless of the fund balances that they carry on that they currently have, it's not near enough to put a dent on the impact that's going to be passing on to counties. And here's the thing, as you mentioned, we cannot drop out any of these participants.
Correct.
But how many more are we going to be enrolling in the years to come?
So to that point, and Commissioner Haas, I think that's what you were leading to, is that in December, the board will entertain a consideration for a program freeze to this program, which would be effective January 1 of 2025. That means that we would essentially freeze the program with the current number of youth that are in there. Because again, we cannot disenroll. That does not exclude, though, child welfare. So when we have a youth that is within our custody as a department, if there is a requirement for child daycare for that youth under CCAP, we have to enroll that youth in that. We have no workaround with that piece.
So a question for council then, are we allowed to provide any services and then we are free zones?
So here's, you know.
So for clarification, though, real quick, Commissioner, on that comment, I did ask the state. So there are other counties that have already gone on to a freeze. So Jefferson County is doing what they call a wait list. And we actually adopted a wait list policy in 2020. We do have to revise that policy should we look at a wait list. A wait list gives us a little more flexibility as it allows us to allow folks or kiddos to age out before we put new ones in. A freeze means that we're on a freeze until we lift that freeze, which means nobody outside of child welfare youth go in. It could be that we wait for 10 youth to come out before we put one in. The problem with that is I asked the state office, Colorado Department of Early Childhood Education, or CDEC, whether or not the federal rule has any concerns or limitations that allows us to freeze or wait list. And the state did not have an answer for me at that time. So I don't know if they have fully read through that federal rule. I would hope that they would have, knowing that this was coming, but ultimately I would hate for us as a county to go on to a policy of wait list or freeze, and then the federal government come back and say, you can't do that. So that's my question that I've posed to the state. I have not received a response as of today. I am awaiting that.
So looking at this whole thing, I mean, we have this universal pre-kindergarten. We have 9 students, and then we have 1, I mean, basically 10 students altogether. On some, the total hour service, 15 hours for the 9 and 1 for 10 for the additional person. But is there any funding coming from UPK?
So currently, that's the other piece of this. So currently, as you mentioned, we've got 9 youth at the full UPK, which is 15 hours. That's the max. Yeah. We also have 1 at 10 hours, which is considered part-time. Currently, CCAP and UPK can be dual enrolled, but it can. However, in 2025, when that sunsets, you can no longer dual enroll youth into both programs, which means that anyone that's under CCAP, if they're required to meet the mandate for 40 hours, the 15 or 10 hours that's currently under UPK can no longer be used as part of that. So that student will also go up in cost for those 15 hours.
So was this UPK sold as snake oil?
I will say this. If you look at the daily rate of what we pay for CCAP versus what UPK is reimbursing, then that's on the sheet. And I did reach out to, again, COG for those numbers. Right now, the daily rate of reimbursement is about $9.90 per youth, whereas CCAP is $96.84 per youth.
Mr. Aragon, I'm going to give you...
Yes, I will say yes.
Okay,
thank you. I will go on record as yes, I do think it was, because our providers have said to us, we're not reimbursed enough with UPK to sustain.
2 questions. And if you can, fine, if not, but I like to find out, what is the shortfall on the UPK through the DHS group, as well as what is this CCAP overall expenditure looks like for the entire state? I think we need to take a look at those bigger numbers. I mean, right now we're concerned about San Luis County, but darn it, that's $1.5 million that we don't have, that eventually we're gonna have to cover. And that is not only an unfunded mandate, that is an oversight. And I'm gonna go out there on the record, say that maybe the counties file a lawsuit against the state for not correcting this sooner. Right now, it's pretty much, we don't want to be grasping at straws, but as we look at the history, then you have law enforcement on another end with all the mandates. Yeah. To bankrupt the county, it won't take long, with a couple of years, and we will be basically scraping bottom. And then you talk about CCAP, all the other programs altogether, the fund balances that the state carries, whether it's on the block or whatever, just not enough to help governments.
It's not. And if I can give some perspective, I did speak with El Paso County's director, and they're projecting a over $4 million overage annually for their program. So if you look at $4 million in El Paso County, multiply that by the 11 big counties, and I did actually meet with Pueblo County yesterday to provide them with how we calculated our numbers, because they are traditionally underspent, but jumping from 6,600 to 17,000 means that their allocation could quickly be exhausted with the number of youth they currently have on there and whether or not they need to freeze that program as well. So even counties that have not traditionally overspent in this program are now in fear of overspending, because that jump is so dramatic and it's so drastic that it could hit their books just as well over the next few years if they don't freeze or waitlist that program. So it's not even a total amount. I think as of right now, the state estimated in the last report I saw that there's a $52 million gap in CCAP funding across the state for the counties. That's the counties who are traditionally overspent in there. That does not account for the counties who currently are underspent and could potentially look at becoming overspent because of this jump in the next 3 years. And I think what bothers me the most about this is that a memo has come out, but there's been really no discussion with CDEC outside of now being interviewed by their their contractor to find out what the impact on counties looks like. I was very transparent with that interview. And in last week's director's meeting, it was brought up that I brought up the concerns about closing our, it's not just the funding, but it's also closing the providers down. That is a huge impact upon us economically, because when people have to quit their jobs to go back to care for their children in the home, that impacts our economy tenfold.
Well, and that's the state as a whole. And that's what I'm
right. I mean,
that's what I'm looking at.
You look at it on a whole.
Yeah.
We're talking about unemployment in the state of Colorado jumping dramatically within a year's time, where it could be double or triple the amount it is now.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle, and it's back on us again.
Right.
Because they're going to be needing more assistance. It's just a
thing. So the director from the county that reached out regarding a letter from the commissioners, her and I have been communicating back and forth, and so I told her we were bringing this data to the board today. I really truly feel like it would be important for counties to rally together. And I think that, you know, independent letters is fine, but I also think that CHSDA and CCI also need to be involved in this communication process. So I look to the board for support and guidance in getting that going with CCI.
Absolutely. If you bring it to CCI, I can make the argument they're going to be there. I'm participating in all those conversations. And I don't know who through CDHS will bring it to us, but definitely... I know Heather is a huge voice when it comes to communication and conversation, whatever you need to do. And I use enough time to make a few phone calls, and I can bet you have, we're probably going to come out of there unanimously supporting a letter from CCI.
And I think part of my concern with it, Commissioner, is that in the director's meeting, as we were discussing this with the state, many of my counterparts were not necessarily paying attention because they're traditionally underspent in the program. And so a lot of directors and counties that don't overspend their CCAP are not aware of what this increase looks like across the board. And so as we began to educate them in that with my conversation with Sarah Dawson at CDEC, I think a lot of those counties are now in our Southeast region, San Luis Valley, saying, wait a minute, what's going on? We need to look at our numbers. So I think that conversation just has been, I don't think the memo was clear enough to and concise enough to communicate to all directors the importance of what this transition looks like. And I think that is where my heartburn lies, is that that kind of communication through a memo should have been initially followed up with a meeting with all directors in the counties to discuss what this jump looks like.
And when you're a big county, and I know of one county that has $144 million in reserves, and there may be a $4 million deficit to them,
yeah.
It doesn't affect them like it does us, you know.
Absolutely.
Well, and
but initially too, think of it this way, that $4 million is for 1 year. If that county is not looking to freeze or suspend that program and waitlist it, that $4 million could easily turn into $12 million the next year, and then $15 million the next, and $30 million the next. So, I mean, it's this, and again, it's that cliff effect we talked about in prior meetings. There were all these things that were coming down the pike, but I think we've seen, you know, there's the lawsuit against the state from the Department of Justice regarding access to IDD. And
has that been settled?
To my knowledge, no, it's still ongoing. But because of that litigation, we've had excess workload provided and put upon our case management agency and our economic security team that was beyond what we traditionally managed. And many counties with long-term care services are struggling to keep up with the mandate because of that. We had the child welfare PIP that's been on the state for quite some time, and change to practice has cost the state and counties millions of dollars to make those shifts So, I mean, all these federal level items that are now just being addressed that have gone unannounced or turned a blind eye to for decades is now catching up. And I'm so happy to be sitting on this side of the desk to have to deal with it now as a county. This is unfair to my staff. It's unfair to the community that we serve. And it's definitely unfair to the taxpayers of this community that work hard to fund these types of programs. You know, this is a mandate that the state made the mess, and now we're having to fix it. And I have made that abundantly clear to CDEC when I met with that interviewer.
There was a news story, I think, on
Fox 21, sometime during the storm, about El Paso County freezing their CCAP.
Yeah, that just came out on Thursday of last week. They announced a freeze to their program.
And what's going to happen on that, counties are going to take the blunt of the negativity because we're denying the services, where the mandate is there to provide the services, but the finances are nowhere to be found. And I tell you one thing right now, this is not the time to go to the taxpayers, regardless of what county you're in. It could be a large county, to go asking for an increase on. And they care. We all care about children. We care about the services that we provide. But there's so many needs that the regular Coloradan is going through the process. They're basically living paycheck to paycheck. We're going to go take another few dollars. You know, I mean, this whole thing has been going on for quite some time. And now the ones that are going to be the barriers of this whole catastrophic decision are going to be the families, regardless of how we translate this whole thing. And then all of us, when we're in the community, well, you know, you guys are not funding it. You're not doing this, you're not doing that. And that's going to be the challenge that we need to address to our constituents. By freezing it, we're basically, in a sense, saying we have a moral responsibility to provide the services to our community. However, we can't go back and get our hand into your pockets again. That is kind of what the way I see this whole thing. And I'm ready to make an argument. We're ready to make this argument at the state level, whatever we need to be. But then we're going to a state that is, in a sense, not able to balance their own budget.
I didn't make that campaign promise. And we should be held accountable for that. Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
It sounded like a campaign slogan.
You know, but that's the reality of what we deal with as a county-driven DHS department, is that as an arm and agent of the state, we are required to meet the mandate to an extent. However, this is a mandate reasonable. This is beyond reasonable. This is a state problem that they're trying to push upon counties, and I disagree with that. Regardless of that, yes, our job is to serve the community with programming that supports it to make our citizens thrive. We can't make our citizens thrive when we can't meet this mandate. It's going to create a bigger issue for how our families and our community thrive when they can no longer access affordable childcare.
When one of the breadwinners has to stay home to do the childcare,
yep.
And I did consider at a moment whether or not this was an attempt to move the CCAP funding to UPK because that rate was not reimbursed at that. However, legislatively, there is no way that the TANF funding could be allocated over to UPK. So there's also an unfunded mandate on the UPK because, as we know, the three initial years was funded by ARPA funding. That has sunsetted in 25. So they are also facing a shortfall in UPK.
Yeah.
And so we're talking two major programs that were promised to our communities. And now those two programs are both on the chopping block. And CCAP is not one we can just tell the federal government we're going to walk away from. We don't want to do this. This is a mandated under the legislation that those TANF funds, those programs have to be in place.
So, you know, when you talk about meeting with CDEP, There was a rulemaking group to review the standards of the providers to meet the qualifications to be able to draw down those dollars. And the standards were going to be basically, in a sense, adopted by the state, adhered by counties for the benefit of those that are under the program. Where are the standards? Did they meet? I've been looking, and I actually have been doing a lot of research trying to get a hold of those standards to see, are they going to be doing a rulemaking revision for a year now? Where you're what, year three?
Year three.
Going into the fourth year, what happened there? And did the program, as Commissioner Haas says, did the program meet the promises that were made to Coloradans?
I don't want to put words in any of our providers' mouths, but in speaking to COG, it seems like that rate is not sufficient for them to survive. If UPK were the only program, COG would have to close its doors.
Well, the promises were made, and what they're basically saying,
they're trying to meet those standards, and they're still not being reimbursed at a reasonable rate. $9.90 per youth a day. What is that dollar amount? I mean, where does that figure come from? Yeah. That is just and you're talking, and if I recall in my conversation with Director Blasi on that, I believe they only have 30, maybe plus a few youth in UPK. It may not even be that high. So it's not a significant funding stream for any provider to have at this point in their programming, with the mandates of the standards that were established and whether or not that rate would be sufficient to be applied to those standards and that reimbursement. I just think that we're looking at a major crisis across the state when it comes to education and youth child care.
You know, early on when the rulemaking process for the standards that were going to be phased, that were going to be introduced in various phases, steps, and you know, we go back and the promise was made, the standards were put up, and now counties go out and provide the services. But however, we're only going to be giving you a tenth of what is actually going to the actual cost. So counties are picking up, even as you're saying, COG, only being reimbursed probably, I don't know exactly the percentage of that, but a very small percentage, yet the services are being provided without. Now the promise became promises made, promises not kept for Coloradans.
I think there's also a cherry on the top of this cake that I haven't even addressed with the board yet that has come to my attention. Our maintenance of effort for this program, and since I've been here in 2020, has been a match by the county of 10.82%. That was because it's my understanding, according to CDEC, that in the early 2012, 2013 timeframe, there was an adjustment to help support counties in meeting the MOE, because I think we were just starting to come out of that recession of 2008 and they were having a hard time. The actual MOE is actually 12.8% some. I believe it's 12.89%. The state is also looking at incrementally over 3 years increasing the MOE back up to the 12.89% from the current 10.82%, because the state is saying they cannot meet the mandate with the allocation amounts. So we're talking about unfunded mandate. Now we're also adding to the cost of the MOE that the county has to meet for the allocation amount on top of that. So there are many factors in this that play into each county and what each county's response to the state needs to look like based on this type of.
Send me the narrative that you want to pitch. We're going to.
I will definitely get that to you in the next week or so, as we need to move on this quickly, because JBC will be convening to work. I believe they're already convening, but we need to get something in front of them quickly. And that's outside of, I think, what the state's estimated mandate or gap in funding is of that 52 million. And I think it's far significantly higher than that.
Is this going to be hit buff? Is that what we're going to be talking
about? No. So in 2022, I believe it was, CCAP was funded and operated under the Colorado Department of Human Services, CDHS. In 22, it moved out from under CDHS and became its own branch under Governor Polis. So CDEC, Colorado Department of Early Childhood Education, is its own standing entity now. And so CDEC will be the agency that we're going to have to work with and communicate with regarding this. Both HCBF and CDHS have nothing to do with this component anymore.
Do you have any better news?
I do, actually, Commissioners. So one last bit of information on a personal note, just to let the Commissioners know, unfortunately, I will not be able to attend CCI coming December.
Okay.
But my constituents who are going will be communicating these concerns in meetings up there, so I do know that this will be on the table. On a brighter note, though, and unfortunately, the team's not here today. Some are online joining us, but I wanted to acknowledge our department, our Division of Economic Security Services, who provides our SNAP, Medicaid, CCAP, those programs. as there's no true designated month of awareness for the work that they do, we are, as an agency, declaring this in November. And so next year, we will actually bring a proclamation to the board, but we will be recognizing our team this week. There's some communication that will be going out on our social media and also through our listserv to help celebrate those folks in that team and the work that they do daily. And so I just want to publicly acknowledge the work that they do every day to help our citizens thrive in Los Angeles County and how they work closely with other counties to support each other. So to that team, I'm grateful to them for the work, the effort, and the time that they put in, because I know that that's not an easy job. And the volume is high. As you know, in our numbers, we see about 8,900 cases within our county. So they're all working that as a team. And so I'm grateful to that team. So we'll be sharing that news out tomorrow, actually.
We'll pass on the sentiment from on behalf of the board. Thank them. There is just not even a way of saying thank you so much for the work that they do. Certainly, it takes a magician to do the work that you all do and the entire team, because it's incredibly satisfying, but yet challenging to meet the demands of unfunded programs that we have to deliver. So thank you. Anything else on your director's report?
No, commissioners, I'll update on some personal leave I'll be taking at the end of December, but I'll do that in the December meeting.
Okay. Thank you. And that's also very important. Take a little time to rejuvenate and...
After this one, I need it.
Yes. Well, we're going to go to the next item. Is that we have a presentation by the Commonwealth Companies, Chaffa Grant for Trinidad Housing Development. Are you, who's going to do that?
We have several folks, I believe, from the Commonwealth Agency online to present. I will turn that over to them. Are you all online? Are you able to hear us?
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, Teddy, we can. You're good to go.
Awesome. Sorry, I'm having some technical difficulties today, so let me know if for some of these stuff cuts in and out. Thank you all for letting me present today. We are here to look for a letter of support for our workforce housing project that will be going into Colorado Housing and Finance in February. Last year, we were unsuccessful in our application to them. And this year, we are hoping to have the opposite result and getting a successful application and getting this project funded. And part of the way that we believe that we can get, you know, this project funded is really bolstering community support. And thus we are here today looking for a letter of support from you all. So I guess that's kind of my presentation. Unless you guys have any questions or comments to add, I'm happy to answer anything you guys have to offer.
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Felix Lopez, chairman of the board. On behalf of this board, thank you for presenting to us. Let me ask a couple of questions. Can you expound? We have the document that you sent on behalf of the Commonwealth Companies that the mark in Trinidad that you are planning to build a 34 unit family development in Trinidad, affordable housing. The development will seek a 9% low income housing tax credit from Chaffa with an application due, of course, in February of 2025. And the development will be deed restricted for 40 years to ensure long-term affordability. Can you expound on affordable housing? I think that term is now elusive. As far as the letter, we'll get into a couple of questions, but expound on what exactly. I know you're looking at medium income MII to 60%. And the 34 units, where would they be located? And if you can describe the project a little bit, would appreciate that.
Yeah, so the project will actually have 30% of AMI units, 50% of AMI units, and 60% of AMI units. So our intent is to not just hit one AMI band. It's the intent is to hit multiple AMI bands. Again, that's Commonwealth's kind of model in development is, you know, workforce housing, and to your point, gets thrown around quite a bit. But our intent is to have workforce housing for the workforce, right? That isn't one AMI band, that's all AMI bands across the board. So therefore, you know, our developments have all AMI bands. Yeah. And so are you looking for like an address of where this project is, or?
Well, no, unless you have a location already selected.
Yeah, so this project's located, you know, right outside of downtown Trinidad, kind of in a commercial-ish residential area. There's existing apartments around us, so it kind of fits the mode. This project's, you know, been developed really in conjunction with the city of Trinidad. Thus, you know, our unit mix is all 2 and 3 bedrooms designed because the city had indicated that, you know, most developments going in are all studios and 1 bedrooms, but they have not had any 2-bedroom and 3-bedroom new construction units in over, I think it was like 20 years. All their 2 and 3 bedroom stock is, you know, older units getting remodeled or just in general older units. So our intent is to, you know, bring those new 2 and 3 bedroom family units online here, you know, next year.
Thank you. Commissioner Ash?
Yeah, I got a question for you. So, What is the current AMI? What is the... Go ahead.
No, so I was going to ask you, I guess, to further, like, what is the...
So what's the average income that you're basing this on? What do you see it as? Did you take that off the census, or how did you arrive at that?
Yeah, so it's a HUD-defined... sorry, I'm looking, I'm pulling up as I speak. Yeah, it's a HUD-defined thing, so it's not something I make up. It's pretty much defined for us. So it looks like the average median income in Trinidad is $38,700 for a 4-person AMI of $67,700. So, you know, our 1-person, if, you know, you're 1-person at 60%, you make, you know, under $40,000 a year. A family of 4, the family would make $56,520 to qualify into the 60% of AMI units. So then obviously we have 30s and 50s as well, which, you know, that hits even lower. And therefore the rents, you know, coincide. So for example, our 1-bedroom rents for 50% of AMI are, you know, around $750 or less. For 30%, that 1-bedroom would be $489. So again, the income to rent is trying to align with, you know, an amount that people can actually save, right?
The state of Colorado, and by the way, thank you again, the state of Colorado for a while, the last couple of years, on some of the construction standards, highly recommended to have these EV ready parking spaces, all electrical. Is the investment for a market like here in Trinidad, do you think it's going to be responsive to EV ready parking spaces as far as having families with electric vehicles, since they are so unaffordable at this point in time? How many families do you think you would be able to house that would have, you know, that's going to be a huge expense on your end that somebody has to pay for, right? But as far as having the electric vehicle parking spaces, is going to be one of those, you know, challenges. And then I guess the final question comes down to it. Will the grid that we currently have in Los Angeles County, Trinidad, support that type of deployment of EV infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, any infrastructure that we build on our site is ours, you know, to pay for, you know, on this deal. So we do an all electric design. That is correct. You know, when it comes to EV stalls, you know, that's a choice. So I think last year we had 1 or 2 EV stalls. So one, basically we run a dual thing. So it's 1 post with 2 plugs, you know, if no one uses them, no one uses them, you know, but in the event someone does, you know, there's two stalls available. So it's not like, you know, our site's lined up with EV stalls that aren't being used. You know, if no one ever uses them, no one ever uses them. It's not a big deal. You know, but we do an all electric design, you know, and design to a, you know, an efficiency code to hopefully, you know, have an efficient building that's not, you know, leaking energy and saving, you know, not only us as the owner, you know, long-term expense, but also saving, you know, the homeowner, ensuring that they don't have leaky windows. Cause you know, no one, you know, everyone who lives in an old house has, you know, the classic gets cold out and all of a sudden your house just drops in temperature and your heater's running at, you know, at all times. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, I mean, to their point, I mean, if no one ever uses the EV stall, no one ever uses the EV stall that we have on site.
Thank you. And my last question is going to be, are you partnering with the local housing authority?
That would be our intent. And that would be solely to, you know, try to get, you know, to have their housing list. We'll accept, you know, 9 project-based vouchers onto the site or 8 project-based vouchers. But yeah, that would be the intent at this point in time.
So Commissioner, if I could just quickly speak to that, and Teddy, I don't mean to interrupt, but I did speak with Director Melissa Feld-Algeier at Housing, Trinidad Housing Authority. He is correct. So the last time the city of Trinidad put forth any kind of 2 or 3 bedroom units for families, was about 25 plus years ago. The concern that Melissa or the director at housing confirmed for me was that right now there is, I believe she said there's a total of 83 Section 8 vouchers available. At this time, I believe only 5 of those are actually in use. And the primary wait list is specifically because we do not have 2 or 3 bedroom houses or units available for families. So the majority of those that are going into housing are currently into 1 bedroom. They are also currently strapped with 1 bedroom and what 2 bedrooms they have, because there are many of their current housing authorities' current properties that have to be renovated and brought up to federal standard before HUD will allow them to be occupied again. So there are several factors that are playing into a limited amount of affordable and accessible at this point housing within Trinidad Housing Authority and throughout the city. So, you know, this is a piece that I've communicated with her on effectively. Our adult protective services, we work closely with them. Child welfare has reached out and worked closely with housing. But this type of a project to bring the number of units that we're looking at would substantially help in assisting and getting some of our folks into a residential setting, into a livable condition, where they would be able to thrive.
And to clarify, Commonwealth Development is the one that's running the show here, right? It's not like this is getting turnkeyed over to the Housing Authority. Commonwealth is the one managing it, taking care of everything. You know, the Housing Authority is just, you know, I guess you'd call it just a partner by name, but they're, you know, part of the deal in the fact that, you know, they're, we'll be working with them, but, you know, running day-to-day management, that'll be, you know, Commonwealth, the long-term owner for the next, you know, 40 years, Commonwealth, you know, that's, it's our name, our reputation. So it's not, you know, I don't want anyone to think that like all of a sudden Commonwealth's going to come build this and then it's keyed over to the Housing Authority and the Housing Authority's, you know, set to run this project, you know, for the next however many years. It'll be, you know, Commonwealth is the one that anyone, if there's ever problems, it'll be, you know, myself you call.
Very good. And, you know, for just one more clarification, the development will be deed restricted for 40 years to ensure long-term affordability. Am I translating this properly, that this unit will, at the very least, will survive 40 years for that specific purpose under the CHAF alone?
Yeah, so as part of these applications, you know, we have to identify how long we'll keep it affordable. And so Commonwealth, yeah, guarantees, you know, that it will be affordable for the next 40 years. And that is, you know, then on us as Commonwealth to ensure that, you know, the project gets maintained and has the ability, you know, to make it 40 years, right? I mean, and then Commonwealth's been around, you know, I think this is their 23rd year of development. So, you know, clearly if we didn't do what we say we're going to do, we wouldn't be around anymore because, you know, in today's age, reputation is everything. And so, yeah, that's our commitment to ensure that this stays, you know, affordable. And to the point, it is deed restricted. So we signed, it's called a land use restriction agreement with the state that says we're going to do this. So you can't just, you know, I'm not just here saying, oh, yeah, we'll do it. And then, you know, 20 years from now or 15 years from now, it'll be, you'll see like market rate apartments for sale. Like that just isn't allowed. And if we were to do that, Commonwealth would, you know, frankly, never be allowed to develop affordable housing again, because you'd be breaking, you know, kind of the golden rule of, you know, housing, which is breaking, I mean, that would be breaking a deed restrictive agreement with the state. Yeah. yeah, that would not be a great thing.
Yeah. Teddy, pardon my ignorance, but so we get this complex built and all the housing is available and it's occupied, and we have a problem. Who does the maintenance on something like that for 40 years? When you're 6 years out and things start going wrong, who does the maintenance?
It would be Commonwealth. I mean, it would fall on Commonwealth's behalf to maintain the building, between, you know, whoever we hire for property management. But it would be, you know, at the end of the day, the buck stops with Commonwealth Development. We're the owners of the building. You know, it's on us to maintain our building, you know, and it will not fall to anyone else. There'd be no fingers for us to point to. Commonwealth's the owner. It's on our behalf to ensure the buildings stay, you know, hopefully as nice as the day we built them. Obviously, in reality, that's every building needs to get remodeled as it goes. But that, again, falls squarely with Commonwealth.
Thank you.
Very good. I don't think we have any more questions on this. Sir, I want to thank you for the presentation. I will work with Director Aragon as far as the letter, and I would imagine, I don't think you need this by when, sir?
By February 1st. That's one update. So we have plenty of time. We're just, you know, trying to get out ahead of it. Again, I mean, we didn't get selected last year. We feel like we were probably the first ones first ones out of the winning pool. So we're just trying to bolster our support and you know, ensure we get out, you know, ahead of this and not wait, you know, to the last minute, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm here saying I need this by, you know, next Thursday.
Yeah. And your company is not a nonprofit, correct?
That is correct.
Correct. Well, thank you, sir. I think we have enough information. I will work with Director Aragon, and we will bring this to one of our fellow commissioners. It's at a different meeting, but I don't see at this point in time any challenges in drafting this letter of support.
Fantastic.
Welcome to Trinidad.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. We're going to go now to unfinished business, section 6, nothing, new business. So for just FYI, you'll work with a sample letter and so on. And
so we do actually have a letter for consideration in your packet today. If the board would prefer to wait until December to look at that and ask our commissioner.
I like to have the three of us as part of the whole thing. I mean, and that's the reason I was asking if you need to us to meet it in the next week or so. But since we have a little bit of time, we have a meeting coming up. Okay,
sure. So when we get there, if we want to just table that, we'll move that to December.
Yes. Well, on this particular, what would you like to do with the share? Approve the letter, and I've read it.
I'd rather have it until December.
Consideration of case law that counts an activity by program. June, July, Mr. Aragon.
So commissioners, again, most of my staff are out either due to jury summons and or state meetings. So Ms. Ringo is here and Ms. Eklund is also standing as both interim finance and deputy director, but also for child support because her staff are conducting hearings at this point. So I'll open the floor if there are questions on case counts or anything that you'd like. I asked them not to bring any report to the board this month, as I figured we were going to spend some quality time on the CCAP discussion and this presentation, but they will present in December.
Unless you want to provide us an update, I mean, completely open. I like that interim title.
I think your nickname should be Arnie for Arnold Schwarzenegger. Some broad shoulders to carry.
I'm very grateful. Very grateful.
No.
Okay.
You know, the only thing, commissioners, is I'm going to send you an invitation to attend our case management agency's CAC meeting. It stands for Now I can think of
Community Advisory Committee.
Yeah, and that is December 9th at the Community Center.
You'll send us an official. Very good. Go ahead.
At 10 a.m.
Yes, okay. So you said cake meeting. I'm there.
Nothing donuts are free. Okay. And I believe you've attended one before. So thank you.
Very good. So on items 7A, subsection 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, since we don't have anything else on that, I will make a motion to approve those items.
Second the motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Olmos?
Yes. 7B, consideration of appointment, appointment of family support council members, parentheses, FSSP program. Back to you, sir.
Commissioners, I believe it was last month we brought forth a list of individuals that we approved for the committee, the Family Support Services Program, FSSP, which was part of our long-term programming that we brought over with the CCB staff. They've now fully integrated into DHS. I think they kind of lost the CCB title about a week in, and so they are DHS staff who are now bringing forth a new list. Unfortunately, we found that two of the agents that were appointed did not reside within Los Angeles County. Actually, to be appointed to this, you must reside in the area. And so this is an updated list of the committee members. And so in front of you is up for consideration and approval to appoint these folks to this board.
So we're looking at the family representative chairperson, Brian Blasi. Parent representative Mary Jo Baldino. We have family representative Ignacio Gutierrez, member representative Ivory Gutierrez, and parent representative Elizabeth Lyles. Any discussion in that, Commissioner Haas?
And you're all good with these?
Yes, Commissioner. So by rule, we must have a minimum of five. We can have up to nine members. Ms. Mason, who oversees the FSP program with long-term care, is also always looking to recruit new, especially client and family representatives to that, because we really want the feedback from those who are receiving the services. And so this list of individuals was selected by Ms. Mason and presented to me, and I'm presenting that to you. So I have no concerns with that appointment.
Thank you, sir. Any more discussion on that?
No, yes, sir.
I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve the names listed here on the membership roster for the appointment of the Family Support Council members, FSSP program.
I second that motion.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Olmos?
Yes. So we now come to the 7C. Thank you, Council, for reading ahead of me.
And I just followed your lead.
Both of us. Go to the principal's office after this. 7C, consideration of letter of support to Commonwealth Companies, CHAFA grant for Trinidad Housing Development. And as per our conversation earlier, I believe that I would like Commissioner Luis Lopez to also weigh in and participate on the decision. So for now, I'm going to make a motion to lay on the table until the next meeting.
Second motion.
Thank you, Commissioner Haas.
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Lopez.
Yes. Okay. Financial matters. Consideration of financials. Financials and bills for September 2024. Ms. Ringo, have a great afternoon.
Commissioners, I did again ask Ms. Eklund to attend, as she's standing in as our interim deputy director, and with her finance management and accounting background, her and I have been working closely, but I haven't asked her to sit in the hot seat quite yet because there's still some training I need to do. So she's in our audience today, but I will say this, I'm thoroughly impressed in the 2 weeks she's been in already and what's already been accomplished. So I'm very grateful to her and her team in child support for taking on the transition so well and dealing with that transition so abruptly. So thank you to her and to Ms. Chrissy Sarah and the DCSS team for child support services.
Carrying a heavy load.
In front of you, commissioners, are several items. I did provide an update to the financial packet today. As you will see, there were two adjustments made in both March and in July to our treasurer's reconciliations. Ms. Eklund and I discussed those, and we did identify the need to adjust those so that we balanced correctly. And so those are in front of you. Also in front of you is the summation page, which has also been adjusted to reflect those. So your September financial statement is accurate to cash in hand, as well as the state and federal reimbursements and expenditures. So if there's any questions on the financials, commissioners, I'd be more than glad to entertain that.
No questions. I want to sincerely say thank you. Thank you for all the work. And this is, finances are fun, but they can be challenging. And I know DHS comes down to a science. The complexity of following a line item from the treasurer back to the department, that's the easiest portion of it, is basically reconciling the distribution of funds, the allocation of the same, and then, of course, the reconciliation, which thank you, and we wish you the best, and hopefully this is going to be where you find the joy that you have been looking for quite a few, you know, on this. I personally enjoy this type of work, so...
The chairman has got a warped.
In defense, I am not in any shape or form an accountant. I've never trained for accounting, but I have lived my life in letters for some reason. And I find these numbers so fascinating and fun to work with. And so I will say this. Legal counsel thinks I'm also completely crazy. So we'll take the crazy, but... you know, I think the reality is that, you know, obviously Deputy Director Fiormanzi had to leave us, unfortunately, and so his departure has left a void, and so Ms. Eklund standing as interim is greatly appreciated. Just for clarification to the board, though, that position is open publicly to anyone that has the credentials met to apply. I encourage anyone that has that to apply. I'm in the current process of building a search and screen, in which I've already spoken to, Director Coberly has agreed to sit upon that search and screen. So awesome. We're hoping to have a full search and screen and start receiving applications. We are receiving applications. I have not had any to date that meet the qualifications.
And what are those qualifications?
So currently what we look for is that they have a bachelor's in accounting with at least 2 years minimum experience in finance management, or at least an associate's degree with 5 years coupled with finance management or a combination thereof. And so, you know, it's really difficult in our area to find people with a bachelor's in accounting, but that doesn't mean that people who have the expertise and knowledge base that don't necessarily have the degree don't have the capability of doing this work. And Ms. Eklund has stood in as she has accounting background, not in governmental accounting, but in her financial management of the child support program, and that I've seen great things done under her purview, and so I'm already seeing that with her time in office now. So
where would a master's of math and a master's in education fit into that role?
Master's of math or a master's in education, you know, the reality is that, you know, just what is their skill set? What is their experience coupled with those degree titles? Accounting is a very different process from a mathematical degree. As somebody who teaches for the School of Business, I have math majors in some of my classes and I have accounting majors, and there's a very different thinking pattern there. So I would really, you know, have to look at the level of experience they've had with financial management, especially either governmental or corporate finance management, which is significantly different in many ways from I think generally accounting, a general accepted accounting experience. This is, as Commissioner Felix Lopez alluded to, DHS books scare folks. It is not an easy thing to navigate, and it is a lot to take in because of not just the funding streams, but there are many different funds that come in that don't necessarily fall under that category. And so we have to make sure that we account for all of those that come in and that we can, in fact, settle out to that. It's not an easy process. And I will say, though, that in our last audit with the auditors, along with now working with Deputy Director Fiorenzi while he was here, and now with Ms. Eklund, I, as director, although have a really vast amount of knowledge in the budget area and the funding streams, the accounting component was an area that I've been educating myself over the last 3 years on. And now I truly feel like as director, I truly understand where our finances lie and what we are looking at potentially moving forward. So thanks to the education I've received from those folks in that little bit of time, I am more comfortable as well. But because I am ED, it does not separate duties appropriately. So I try not to touch the finances. I verify that they are correct. And so that's the education I've been receiving, is to ensure that I can verify that correct.
Before you sign off?
Correct. Correct. So.
Well, thank you for that lesson. I don't think on the financial matters, I don't have any questions. The commission has for the financial and bills for September 2024. Having no other questions, I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve the financials and bills for September 2024.
I second that.
Commissioner Nass?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes. 8B, consideration of payroll for pay date September 13th and 30th of 2024. Back to you, sir.
And commissioners, I don't know if you want a consent agenda items B and C, since they're both for September and October. It's the payroll for both months, and that would get us caught up fully.
Yeah, that would be, I would support that. So we're going to be looking at the consideration of payroll for pay dates September 30th, 13th and 30th, and then 15th and 31st of October. And you've attached the payrolls to this documentation, of which we appreciate.
So, commissioners, for September 13th, our payroll was $122,328.61. For September 30th, the amount was $121,381.22. For October 15th, our total salary was $125,147.88. And that also includes a $2,596.38 comp payout in October. And then in our October 31st, salary was a total of $115,533 and no change.
May I interject? On the minutes for my October, I have those figures that you just read for September.
Did we approve them? I couldn't find it.
I don't know where I got them, but I have it. It's exactly what I did for the September 13th and the September 30th.
Okay. Well, I did read them in the minutes. So, I mean, does it hurt?
It doesn't hurt to.
Okay. Get. Just so that we encumber them and make sure they're all in there. Okay. Any questions on payroll?
No questions. I don't think we can answer. Okay. So now I will motion to approve A, B, and C. Consideration of payroll for pay date September 13th and 30th, 2024, and the payroll for pay dates October 15th and 31st.
Second motion.
Commissioner Hass?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes. And at this time, we don't have any other items on the agenda. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn this meeting.
So
moved.
Second.
Commissioner Hass?
Yes.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes.
Thank you, commissioners. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I hope you're a permanent applicant.